The meeting of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Division will come to order. A quorum is present. Representative Lee, have you looked at the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move approval of the minutes from February 27, 2020.
Representative Lee moves the approval of the February 27th, 2020 minutes. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. Minutes are approved. Members, we have a number of bills today, and we've moved the schedule around as from what was posted because we have some testifiers that aren't able to stay, and we have some members that have bills up in other committees as well. So our first bill is going to be Representative Adelson with carbon sequestration report. And Representative Adelson, just in this room, you often have to eat the microphone to make sure that people are heard. So welcome. Oh, I move that House File 3590 be recommended to be referred to the Energy, Climate Policy and Finance Division. Representative Adelson.
Thank you, Chair members. My husband always says I talk too loud, so I'll work on this. House Bill 3590 allows an appropriation for the 2021 fiscal year from the general fund to the Board of Regents of the University of Minnesota. This appropriation would allow the University of Minnesota to investigate the potential for using carbon sequestration. Carbon sequestration is a process of removing carbon from the atmosphere and storing it. Chair members, I want to move to the professor who, thank you for letting us go first because he has a flight to San Diego. Professor Jason Hill from the University of Minnesota Department of Bioproducts and Biosystems Engineering.
Thank you, Chair
Hill.
Oh, thank you, Chair. And you're right about this microphone, aren't you? And members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak to you today. I speak to you as an expert witness, not as a representative of the university's larger requests. I very much appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about this issue of carbon sequestration. I come before you as somebody with a very vested interest in carbon. In fact, I'm one-fifth carbon. My family, going back generations, is also one-fifth carbon, and I imagine that most of you are probably one-fifth carbon as well. I want to mention three words today that I think sum up my thoughts about the importance of this bill for Minnesota. First word is prosperity. Minnesota's prosperity is and has been since the beginning of our state based on carbon. It's the carbon and the lignin and the cellulose, the wood, that for so long has been the a major export of our state. It's the carbon in the carbohydrates, fats, and protein in our agricultural commodities that are sent all over the world. This carbon has made us rich and has the potential to continue to make us rich into the future. This brings me to the second word, waste. We waste a lot of carbon. A lot of carbon is lost in the water as it's exported in soils down to the Gulf of Mexico. It's lost in the air as carbon dioxide, carbon and dust. And these wastes become pollutants, whether it's polluting the air leading to climate change, whether it's polluting the water leading to eutrophication, whether it's dust that leads to premature mortality, people dying early as a result of breathing this in. So carbon has the potential for prosperity. It's also a waste. And that brings me to my third word, which is opportunity. We have an opportunity with carbon sequestration to prosper more and to waste less, to pollute less. And that's what carbon sequestration is. It's storing carbon and making it work for us. It's making it work for us both directly, in that by enriching our soils, we can further prosper from the products from it. And it's enriching us indirectly because there's economic demand for products with lower carbon footprints, with products that have more environmentally beneficial profiles, products that are more sustainable. So we can benefit from carbon sequestration. But there's a lot we don't know, and I think that's where this bill helps fill in the gaps. What sorts of things can be done in Minnesota to further store carbon? What sorts of things can be done that store carbon permanently, that we can be sure that are going to store carbon, not just in the near term, but also in the long term? What sort of things can be done to store carbon effectively? What sort of things can be done at low cost options with high return on our investment? Also, how large is this opportunity? Once we know what sorts of things we can do, what is the potential for carbon storage in Minnesota? It's not just an academic exercise. This tells us what sort of real benefits we can get once these sorts of direct and indirect carbon markets are opening. Also, who might benefit from this? So there, if we're looking at different ways to store carbon in different places and different amounts, different people are going to benefit from that differently. So we can look at sort of distributional effects as a result of this. There are going to be cost and benefits to this, and there may also be co-benefits. There might be other benefits for water quality and air quality and so forth for these sorts of practices that store carbon. So I'll just sum up by saying that there, we know that there's tremendous potential. Other states have seen this too in carbon sequestration. But there's a lot we don't know about how, for how long, what's most cost effective, who's going to benefit from it, and to what degree. And those are the sorts of things that further information can help us understand. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Dr. Hill or Representative Adelson? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, to the bill author, why do we, why would we take from the general fund and not LCCMR?
Representative Adelson.
Thank you, Chair and members. I can look into that. I guess I don't know. I didn't think about. I just went straight to the general fund. I apologize. I can look into seeing about if that would be possible to do.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it might be something that the chair of this committee might be interested in. Who knows? And then to Professor Hill. Now, I just kind of curious, so I just perused through one quick web search, and it appears that these studies have been done over and over and over and over again. What are the results of those other studies?
So,
Professor Hill.
Okay, Chair, members of the committee. So these sorts of studies have shown that Minnesota does have large potential to benefit from carbon sequestration efforts. But there's a lot that's changed, and there's a lot of new information that would be incorporated in additional studies. For example, and I'll give you a very specific example, there has long been interest in using reduced tillage and no tillage as a practice for storing additional soil carbon in agricultural soils. And for many years, markets were built on that. Recent work has come out that suggests that the story is much more complicated than it originally appeared, and that some of the early results may have been based on soil compaction, sort of a sampling error, if you will. And so we need to look further at whether the practices that have been explored and have been sort of formed the basis from those earlier studies actually are up to date. Sort of benefit to exploring this further is that markets change, and there is great additional interest now, not only from public sector but also in private sector, in carbon sequestration. It is a marketable attribute for many products, and many large corporations are looking to market this. And so knowing more about that can help us understand what the real benefits might be.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fabian.
Representative Edelson, on line 1.6, it says you will work in cooperation with state agencies. Which state agencies specifically, or how is that going to be determined?
Chair, Representative Torleson. You know, identifying the exact state agencies, I guess I would have to look a little bit further and figure out who would also need to be stakeholders in this. Just to, I wanted to include, make sure that we're including a state agency, but specific, I guess maybe House research or staff could help me with that answer of who would be maybe a good stakeholder on this.
Mr. Chair, members, it would be up to the U on who would they would choose to work with, but you know, I would expect them to work with DNR, PCA, Bowser, and others.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Edelson, have you had any conversations with any of the state agencies about this bill?
Representative Edelson.
Chair, Representative Fabian, no, I have not.
Representative Fabian, thank you. Thank you. Professor Hill, excuse me. Although if you're not an official duty, maybe it is Mr. Hill. What type of research is the U doing on this now?
Representative, members of the committee, the U has quite a lot of efforts through our Institute on the Environment, through our many departments in CFANS and College of Science and Engineering and many other groups. I'm not aware of any specific efforts that have pulled all this together to look specifically at Minnesota and the opportunities that lie for us. I can say, though, that the university has experts in all these areas, and these experts talk very frequently on these sorts of issues. So if you're looking for homegrown and home-fostered talent that can inform these sorts of issues, there certainly is quite a lot at the university.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then finally, Representative Edelson said in her opening testimony that this bill would allow the University of Minnesota to do that. So in conjunction with that, how are those other studies currently being funded, and what would be preventing you from doing this study without the legislature coming to you and telling you to do it?
Mr. Hill.
Representative, members of the committee, I by no means have a comprehensive grasp on all the research activities at the university. A lot of the work that is being funded on carbon sequestration potential of different practices and the market benefits of these sorts of things is funded by a lot of federal agencies. I know in my own work, work on carbon footprinting and so forth is funded by USDA, Department of Energy, EPA, and so forth. But that work is not specific to Minnesota. So if we're looking at the potential for Minnesota, both on private and public lands, for carbon sequestration, all wrapped up in one report that can be actionable by Minnesotans, for Minnesotans, then that sort of report is what is outlined in this bill here.
But Representative Fabian.
I apologize, Mr. Chair, but my question was, what would be preventing you from doing this now without the legislature?
Representative, member of the committee, I'm accountable for my time at the university. I'm on a 50% teaching, 50% research appointment. I have classes that I must teach for undergraduate and graduate students. I am responsible my time to the funders of our current grants from EPA and USDA and so forth. So my time is allocated to those different efforts. This bill specifically, I will note, is not marked in any way for my particular research group. I'm simply speaking about the topic of carbon sequestration.
Representative Lewick and then Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Professor Hill, interesting, you mentioned that the market's changed and a lot of big companies may be interested in this. Doesn't the university actually solicit opportunities for industry to come in and actually fund these kind of studies?
Members of the committee, the university does have many private partnerships. I personally do not engage in those private partnerships. My own work is funded through competitive grants. That's a choice that I've decided to make so that I don't have those sorts of potential conflict of interest.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, well, I would suggest that that might be a great idea to kind of explore that, at least in agriculture on that side of the university. A huge, huge amount of that research is done by doctorate and graduate students, is funded by private industry, and that partnership works very well. I'd always like to hope you'd go there first before you'd even come here. Thank you.
Chair, I again just want to be very clear that Professor Hill did not come to me. I asked him to be an expert. Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
This is for Professor Hill. You talked a little bit about, early on there was, studies about the reduced tillage and no-till, and, there's been a little bit more studies that maybe wasn't as effective, or if I'm understanding correctly, that it wasn't storing carbon as effectively as possible. But then you talked a little bit about being a marketable attribute. So are there practices that you are seeing as being able to store carbon, maybe it's through grazing or something like that, that maybe you want to answer that first?
Members of the committee, yes, in fact, there are many practices. So I'm involved with a group at Iowa State, for instance. It's an experiment called the Marsden Farm Experiment, where we've looked at increasing the rotational diversity by adding in other crops, the forage crops and small grains and so forth. So going from a two-year corn-soy rotation to other three- and four-year rotations. And what we found in that experiment, for instance, that we can increase soil carbon while at the same time maintaining farmer profitability through increased rotational diversity. So there are these options, but that's an experiment that's been done in Iowa. Now, we have every reason to believe that that sort of thing would likely hold in Minnesota, but those are the sorts of experiments elsewhere that we can pull into to a Minnesota-centric study of this particular topic.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And kind of following up on that, a marketable attribute. So if a farm is able to store carbon, would they be able to sell a credit? Is that kind of what would be the goal of the study, or maybe one of the goals of this?
Members of the committee, absolutely. This is the this is going to happen whether or not there is a de facto carbon market. Many large corporations, those involved in the food system, are marketing foods with lower carbon footprint, done with sustainable practices, for instance. And so, whether or not there's that pass-through through a market, these are the sorts of things that have value and that are being demanded by consumers. I mean, one only need look at the sorts of dietary changes that have happened even in recent years of looking at, say, meat substitutes. Diets can change very quickly, and markets, producers can be nimble to those changes, but they need to know what's actually going to have long-term lasting effect. And so if a farmer, for instance, is investing heavily in a practice that is shown later not to have some sort of real effect, that's not going to be as effective as if we do our homework early on and have confidence that we're going to have long-term benefits.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify? Representative Adelson, any closing comments?
And no, thank you, Chair. And I just want to let the committee know that I'll be following up and looking into the state agencies. Thank you, Representative Fabian, for your suggestion. And just thank you for your time today.
I will renew my motion that House File 3590 be recommended to be referred to the Energy and Climate Policy and Finance Division. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay.
No.
No.
Ayes have it. Congratulations. Next bill up is House File 3271. I should note that last bill, there was a letter in your packet from the Nature Conservancy, and that will be in support, and that will be posted on the committee website. House File 3271, I move that House File 3271 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. Representative Christensen, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are these working? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I was going to say I'm a teacher, and when we were having technical difficulties, just call the 11th grader, and they'll be able to come and fix it, but it sounds like it's fixed. I'm here to represent House File 3271, and we're requesting $1 million in one-time funding for the general, from the general fund, excuse me, for fiscal year 2021 to support the Explore Minnesota Tourism New Community Events Grant Program. The bill is supported by a long list of bipartisan authors, including many on the committee. The authors are spread all over Minnesota. This is a great program. The Explore Minnesota Tourism New Community Events Program has successfully brought small, mid-sized, and large events to communities across the state of Minnesota since the program was first funded in 2016. The successful and popular New Events Program shines a spotlight on Minnesota and attracts first-time visitors who often return for both tourism and business purposes. The program is designed to generate economic impact and increase media awareness in the state as an event destination by securing or creating new events in communities across the state. Eligible events must be new to Minnesota or not have been held in Minnesota in the last 3 years and open to the public. Since the program began, grants have been provided to communities and organizations from Rochester to Roseville, Otter Tail County to Winona, from Lake of the Woods to Albert Lea, Cook County, Duluth. These grants go directly to the attraction and operation of new events to the state of Minnesota. I am a member of the Explore Minnesota Commission, and I'm also one of my towns in my district, Stillwater, has been a beneficiary of one of these grants. We had an event last summer called Opera on the River, and we had opera singers, whom two of them I taught in class, I'll have you know, local opera singers, come and sing in a pavilion on the river, and it was a tremendously successful event. Especially successful that time, especially for businesses, because it was an absolute deluge rainstorm and everyone went into the businesses and had drinks and dinner. It was a fantastic experience for our town, and now that same group, the Opportunity Group, is performing all over the valley a few times a year. In your packets is a map of Minnesota showing past grant recipients, and you'll see the grants have been spread across the state. Information about the grant program with a list of supporters and several letters of support. So first of all, I have testifiers. I'd like to bring up Megan Christensen of Visit Grand Rapids.
Welcome, Ms. Christensen.
Thank you, Chairman Hansen and representatives. My name is Megan Christensen. I'm the executive director of Visit Grand Rapids. I'm here to talk about the economic impact of events on Greater Minnesota. Greater Minnesota encompasses small to medium-sized destination marketing organizations, or also known as convention visitor bureaus. We represent diverse Minnesota destinations from 1,000 Grand Lakes to prairie lands and everything in between. We are primarily rural with populations in size of a couple thousands to tens of thousands. We market and promote our regions to promote visitors to vacation in our areas. Our annual budgets range in tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands. Explore Minnesota grants allow us to stretch our marketing dollars and take part in advertising opportunities that would not be viable without. We rely on Explore Minnesota Tourism to market the state in order for potential visitors to be aware of the diverse travel opportunities across the state. I now share events funding impact to the Grand Rapids area specifically. Itasca County has increased its tourism economy by 9.5%, which totals over $10 million in the past 9 years. Itasca County employs over 1,500 in leisure and hospitality industry. Tourism is one of our main industry sectors in Itasca County: taconite, timber, and tourism. Visit Grand Rapids was able to take advantage of an EMT events grant by forming a partnership with Itasca YMCA and the Running the Rapids Committee. We hosted our first half and full marathon in 2018. Itasca County received a grant of $5,723.50, which allowed the Running the Rapids Committee to double their paid marketing budget. Digital TV and radio ads reached thousands of people living in Minnesota and outstate, featuring Grand Rapids as being a destination marathon location. The Running the Rapids takes place at the end of August, which is the beginning of our shoulder season in northern Minnesota. We have been seeing a decrease in lodging bookings at the end of August due to many school starts before Labor Day, as well as extracurricular sporting activities for youth starting before Labor Day as well. As a result of the EMT funding, Running the Rapids ads cross-promoted other events that were happening the same weekend. Live music, a horse show at the Forest History Center, Watercraft Rentals, and the New Craft Brewery, and more. The committee received feedback from out-of-town runners that came for the race and stayed overnight to experience all that Grand Rapids had to offer. Over 800 people attended the first year's event. 310 people raced. Visit Grand Rapids saw 100 overnights attributing from the event and an average of 110 per night. The first year's goal was to have 200 runners. They had over 300 runners the first year. They didn't expect to have any out-of-town runners, and they had over 80. I want to thank you for considering to increase the Explore Minnesota events budget, because it will allow for us to continue our shoulder season tourism that is essential to the economy in greater Minnesota. Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Christensen? Thank you. Ms. Wern.
Okay, Mr. Chair, thank you. Next is Julie Weem from the Roseville Visitors Association.
Thank you, committee. Thank you, Chair. My name is Julie Wern, and I am the CEO of Visit Roseville in Roseville, Minnesota. In 2016, we started working on a strategic plan for our city, which developed over a two-year time span. We interviewed our customers, residents, and key stakeholders to determine what they thought of Visit Roseville. We scored above average for destination strength and community support. Our tagline is perfectly positioned, as we are a first-tier suburb that touches both Minneapolis and St. Paul. But we discovered we had an identity problem. People staying in Roseville just as easily said they were staying in Minneapolis or St. Paul. Even our 55113 zip code pulls up as St. Paul, and the University of Northwestern St. Paul is in Roseville. The study suggested we create a signature event to raise our profile, so we came up with Revival, a two-day event that included sunset yoga, a 5K run, a one-mile family fun dog walk, closing night concert with the Purple Experience with Marshall Chardoff, who is a Prince lookalike, and he sounds exactly like Prince. It was phenomenal. All this was held at Rosedale Center in July of 2018 in the parking lot where Herberger's used to be. Now, we are a small DMO with a staff of 4 and a budget of $1 million. We do not have access to major corporate sponsors, so we applied for, and I say won, a grant for $34,373, to be exact. This allowed us to dream bigger than we originally thought. We created with Rosedale a major social media marketing campaign. We contracted with Hubbard Radio, KS95, MyTalk, City Pages, Lavender Magazine, and blog influencers that resulted in 850,000 organic media impressions, and online with Hubbard Radio stations, 2.3 million paid impressions. Rather than try to put this event on ourselves, the grant allowed us the opportunity to work with professionals at Anderson Race Management for the 5K and Family Fun Dog Walk, and Kernsteiner Productions to oversee all the concert details. This event brought recognition to Roseville and showed the city what we could do on a bigger scale. They have become great supporters. We involved our restaurants and local brewery and highlighted Roseville Charities, Kids in Needs, and the Sheridan Story. Our post engagement on social media, Twitter, and Facebook was over 3,600 interactions, and we had almost 3,000 video views of the overall event. These grants are awesome for small cities that might not have budgets to put on the events themselves. It gives us an opportunity to shine a light on our cities and all we have to offer from a hospitality point of view. Everyone has the opportunity to create new events or to bid on existing events that are new to their community, and this all shows off the state of Minnesota. On the flip side, when major cities apply for new grant funding, all of the surrounding communities benefit from overflow room nights, so it's a win-win for everyone. I will end with a quote from Maura Gass, CEO of Irvine, Texas, that resonates with the hospitality industry everywhere. If you build a place where people want to visit, you'll build a place where people want to live. If you build a place where people want to live, you'll build a place where people have to work. If you build a place where people want to work, you'll build a place where business has to be. And if you build a place where business wants to be, you'll be back to building a place where people want to visit. It all starts with a visit, and this visit doesn't happen without us. And with these grants, we are enticing new people to come in and visit. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Barton.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Christensen.
Next is Bob Barton, Hidden Haven Resort, Cohasset and Community of Minnesota Resorts.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Barton. I own Hidden Haven Resort in Cohasset, and I am a proud member of the Community of Minnesota Resorts, who I'm here representing today. And our organization is in full support of Senate File 3271 requesting the $1 million for the Community Events Grant Program. Now, while these kind of events aren't necessarily a huge impact to the resort community because they tend to be two or three night events, and during the summer, we're week-long booking cycle. They do supply an opportunity for our guests to go into the community and spend dollars. And so we support that because we do understand that in our rural economies, we all sink or swim together. These local businesses are the same, the ones that we spend our dollars at buying supplies or where we eat or where we recreate. These are the same places that our customers go in the summer. And the viability of our local businesses is paramount to our local economies. I think one of the things that gets overlooked in these discussions is the effect of what online shopping has done to our local businesses. In small communities, we all know the people that we're buying from, that we shop at. They're our friends, they're our neighbors. And I can tell you that in Itasca County, I know many retailers who are seeing 20 to 30% drops in sales due to online purchasing. So the effect of these community events and the influx of dollars that come into our community is major in making sure that these companies stay viable, because they're getting hammered. And online shopping, like it or hate it, it's here to stay. In our local communities, I once saw a statistic a couple years ago that in Itasca County, a dollar that's spent in our county changes hands 5 times before it exits our community. And the lesson that I take away from that is we can't sit in our communities and swap dollars, because they leave really quick. We need that influx of dollars coming from the Twin Cities, coming from outstate Minnesota. But we primarily need them from out of the state, because what applies to our small economy, I think, applies to the state community. We need dollars from out of state because they leave us. So I think that is one thing that we just can't overstate, is the importance of that influx of dollars. And these grants provide the impetus for that. I once saw a statistic that if you want to apply for one of the major league fishing tournaments to come to your community, the application fee alone can be in the tens of thousands of dollars. And what these communities need to do these things is some capital, because sometimes those initial costs going in can be insurmountable. Being a businessman, I always want to know what's the payback. So according to the U of M's 2016 Business Climate for Resorts in Otter Tail County report, the average guest spends $77 today, or per day, not including lodging, in stores and establishments that surround the resorts in that county. So the average person in 2016 was spending $127 per day. And I might say that $50 a day in lodging in peak season, that's pretty conservative. For an event that required a grant of $15,000, it would take $218 in sales to return the grant money back to the state, which translates in $1,700 guests spending $127 a day. For an event lasting more than one day, you can see how the sales tax money piles up quickly. just anecdotally, you know, my wife and I, our kids have grown up, they've moved off, we're the only ones operating the resort anymore. We talk to our guests. We know where they're shopping. We know how much they're spending. I mean, they come in and they brag about, oh, geez, I was just at Super One Foods and we dropped $500. Well, you go talk to any of the retailers that are in our community, and they will tell you the same thing. They make their payments in the winter. They make their living in the summer. And that's what these grants provide, is viability. So my wife and I have this unscientific way of determining how much money is being spent. I don't know what it is, but the guests at our resort never throw away a plastic bag. They stuff them underneath the kitchen sink, underneath the cupboards. And on Saturday morning, we go in and we start pulling out dozens of bags, and it's Walmart, and it's Target, and it's L&M Fleet Supply, and it's Super One Foods, and it's Glenn's Army Navy. We know they're spending money in our communities, and we need to keep that going. So on behalf of the community of Minnesota Resorts, we ask for your favorable consideration of this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Barton?
Mr. Chair, Sarah Pisick, Minnesota Tourism Growth Coalition. Thank you.
Ms. Pisick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Sarah Pisick with the Minnesota Tourism Growth Coalition, and I'm not going to repeat anything that the great testifiers from outside of here said. I want to point out that you should have all gotten your Explore Minnesota Tourism box. I was going to share some of the general tourism economic impact statements, but they are all on the box, so you have them in front of you. And then I also just want to make sure you look at the handout that's included that points out has excerpts about some of the events that have happened, including the International World Plowing Competition that happened in Baudette this summer, brought competitors from over 28 different countries. Switzerland was one of the winners. Austria had 55 people come from Austria to cheer on their team. They spent a couple of weeks in Baudette. That event happened because of one of these community event grants. That competition won't be held in the U.S. for another 30 years. If you want to see it next summer, you have to go to Russia. So that's one of the impacts of this grant fund. There's letters in there from Visit Mankato, from the Adaptive Sports USA that had an event here. That event brought families with their athlete with special needs, and they competed, but they spent a lot of time touring around Minnesota and enjoying all that we had to offer. So I just want to thank Representative Christensen, thank many, many of you who are co-authors, and all the support we've had over the years. There's a great need for this event. The funds will go quickly. I can guarantee nothing will be left over for unused funds at the end of the fiscal year. So anything you can do, we'd really appreciate your support.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a couple questions. Explore Minnesota got, what was the request they had from the budget year last year? Do you remember?
Yep. So for this, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Green, for this grant fund, they had requested $2 million in one-time funding, and they got $60,000.
Okay. Thank you. And then,
Representative Green.
I know it probably says in here, what is the average grant that's given out?
Mr. Chair and Representative Green, I don't have an average amount, but I know that some grants are as small as $5,000 in communities. In greater Minnesota, there is a requirement that funds be spent outside of the metro. The whole pot cannot go in the metro area. I have a sheet here, and I can get you this. Some grant amounts were $4,000, $5,000, a $50,000 one. Some of the larger ones are in the metro area, a $100,000 grant. Is coming up for an event that's coming next week for the U.S. Cross Country Championships that'll be held here in a couple weeks. There's been a lot of advertising on the radio for that lately, especially with the U.S. Olympic gold medal winner, Jesse Diggins, who was from Stillwater. That event is coming here to Minnesota, and that was one of the larger grants. But I can get you a spreadsheet with all the grants that have been given out to date.
Thank you. And then, Mr. Chair, the $1 million that you're asking for here, is this, have you ever had anything this big before?
In this Mr. program? Chair, Representative Green, pretty close. The first year that it was awarded funding was from the legislature in 2016, and that was $673,000. And then in the next budget cycle, 2017, it received $900,000. And I don't remember if it was $900,000 even or, but it was like $900,000.
Okay, and then one last question, Mr. Chair. This looks like a really good applicant for Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Have you checked into going there for this money instead of the general fund?
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, no.
Okay.
We have not.
Is there anyone else that would like to testify on the bill? Anyone else that would like to testify in the audience? Any other questions? Closing comments, Representative Christensen.
Okay, well, thanks for listening. I think my testifiers said it all. I sure hope you support House File 3271. Thank you.
I renew my motion that House File 3271 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. The bill is laid over. Representative Wolgamott. I would move that House File 3245 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. Representative Wolgamott, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members. I'm here to present House File 3425 to provide a one-time appropriation of $100,000 from the Environmental Fund to the MPCA to inventory and assess the state's wastewater infrastructure for its vulnerability to adverse impacts from climate change, including increased heavy precipitation and storm events. Then, Mr. Chair and members, the MPCA must develop a plan to address the vulnerabilities identified, including estimating funding needs, and submit a report to the Capital Investment Committee and the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Committee by January 15th, 2021.
And members, I have a couple oral amendments to get the bill in the shape the author would like. I would move on line 1.7 to insert where it says .. 100,000. And then afterward, where it says general, to strike general and insert environmental. So it would be, the appropriation would be 100,000 in fiscal 2021 is appropriated from the Environmental Fund if the oral amendment passed. Is there any discussion on the oral amendment? Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Amendment passes. Representative Wolgamott, to the bill. Do you have your testifiers?
I do, yes. I would like to welcome Kate Knuth from the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy.
Ms. Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Kate Knuth. I'm a climate policy advisor with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and here to support House File 3425 today. As the committee is well aware, climate change is here. The evidence is clear. For example, 65% increase in 3-inch storms in the last 100 years, significant increases in mega rain events. And whether it's the Rushford floods in 2007 or the Duluth floods in 2012, these changes are already affecting our communities. And the impacts of climate change on our water infrastructure are also ongoing outside of these specific disasters. For example, in the city of Mankato, there is a drinking water well along the river in Mankato. A decade ago, it was 73 feet from the riverbank, and it currently lies about 15 feet from the riverbank because of erosion happening from ongoing flooding in the river. The well is responsible for about 30% of the city's drinking water needs. So we know that climate change is already happening. It's already affecting our infrastructure, and it's projected. Those data are from climate change that's already happened, and it's projected to get even worse. What we don't know is how much these impacts will cost and how to pay for them going forward. I've been working in the adaptation space for several years, and for many months I've been looking for the kind of information that this bill seeks to create, and it just doesn't exist in a comprehensive way. The science isn't there documenting in a comprehensive way the impacts of climate change on our infrastructure, and importantly, how much it will cost. we don't have the information we need to prepare to adapt to climate implications on infrastructure, including the financial implications of those impacts. So we really appreciate Representative Wolgamott bringing forward House File 3425. And we'd suggest a couple changes, which I'll just suggest them and you can discuss. But this bill is focused specifically on wastewater infrastructure. We also have stormwater infrastructure and drinking water infrastructure in the state, all of which are affected by climate change. And so looking at how climate change affects all of our water infrastructure and the financial implications of that, we think would be an improvement to the bill. We look forward to this committee and others having, if this bill passes and advances and a study comes out of it, having a broader and better informed conversation about the real and significant infrastructure and public financial impacts of climate change. There are important open questions, both about the costs of climate change impacts and adaptation and who should bear these costs over time. This bill and subsequent study will help all of us as Minnesotans and a state answer these questions, and we're here to continue to help in these conversations. Happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Ms. Knuth? Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Carrie Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
Members, my name is Carrie Jennings. I'm Research and Policy Director at Freshwater. We're a nonprofit and we work on Minnesota waters. I am here to testify in support of House File 3425. And I want to ask, who's toured the Pig's Eye Wastewater Treatment Plant? It's a great tour. And it's a really good opportunity for you to understand what wastewater treatment actually is. First of all, it's at the downhill end of the metro. That's kind of essential. And just by being there, it makes it vulnerable to increased flow in the rivers. Wastewater treatment plants have to be located on or near rivers because the water is carrying our waste, and we have to return that water to the river. So hopefully we're returning it in a cleaner state. The wastewater treatment plant is going to be impacted by increased flows and already has been impacted by increased flows. And that means that sometimes you have to inadvertently release water without treating it if it overwhelms the ability of the treatment plant to handle it. So that's one of the larger impacts. And I want you to think about this as impacts not necessarily to just wastewater treatment plants, but to our water. So we have to return this water to the river. So these impacts are really being borne by the river themselves. So increased flows and inadvertent discharge will release more untreated waste, more bacteria, more nutrients to the river. And in a warming climate with warming rivers, that's going to increase the unbeneficial algae that are operating in our rivers and lakes now. So we might potentially see more cyanobacteria as these warmer waters get the nutrients that are released and bypassed our wastewater treatment plants. So they're not only damaged to overflows, but they are also just physically vulnerable to damage from being in a floodplain that is widening with banks that are eroding. sorry, I was a little distracted there. I'm thinking more about wastewater and the opportunities in wastewater and the current impacts that our wastewater treatment also has on the environment, because wastewater treatment plants do release greenhouse gases. If you have the right combination of bacteria, algae working the system, you can reduce the release of methane, which is also a nuisance gas. Most people are complaining about those releases because they smell bad. And I think there's also an opportunity to harvest the energy, the thermal energy, and just the flow of the water from our wastewater treatment plants and think of that as more of a circular economy of wastewater treatment. So for those points, I would hope that this bill could expand a little bit and include those other opportunities in wastewater infrastructure. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any questions? Thank you. Katrina Kessler. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Katrina Kessler, Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency for Water and Agriculture Policy. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 3425. We agree that there is a need to understand and mitigate the impacts of climate change on the state's critical water infrastructure. Minnesota has experienced record levels of precipitation, as you've heard, over the last 5 years, with 2019 being the wettest year on record. An increased frequency of intense precipitation events puts additional stress on already aging and stressed wastewater infrastructure. As pipes age, they crack, and clear water from rainfall events and surficial groundwater can enter the sanitary system and overwhelm the capacity of pipes and treatment plants. When this happens, untreated wastewater can be released into basements and receiving water bodies and creates a human health and environmental health concern. Overflows have increased in frequency in the last 5 years, with over 200 annual discharges of untreated wastewater into the state's receiving water in 3 of the last 5 years. Climate impacts can only make a bad situation worse. This bill begins to address what is quickly becoming a costly problem for those who operate wastewater facilities that serve millions of Minnesotans. The MPCA shares the author's interest in addressing this problem. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To PCA, do you support taking the money from the Environmental Fund for the study?
Ms. Kessler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, we do not take a position on the money. The governor's budget has not come out yet.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kessler, I'm sorry.
Ms. Kessler.
Can you tell me which, you said last year was the wettest year, and trust me, in Northwest Minnesota, I know what you're talking about, but can you identify for me the cities who had a wastewater treatment system that failed?
Ms. Kessler, Commissioner Kessler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, we can get you that information. I don't have all of those 200 with me today.
Thank you. Representative Beckerfitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to weigh in. When we visited, the Environment Policy Committee visited Bemidji, we toured their wastewater treatment plant, and the guy that was giving us the tour was talking about one step sort of in the process of how the water cycles through, and he was talking about how expensive that part was, but he was like, but we only have to run it from like April to October, and so it should last a really long time. And so then I asked him, well, why is it they only run it from April to October? And he said, oh, well, because when it's colder, the bacteria that piece of the cycle takes care of, we don't have to worry about that because it's too cold for that bacteria to live. And so that saves us from having to run it year round. And so then I asked him, I said, well, do you think about climate change? Like, what's going to happen if our temperatures are rising? And he clearly had not thought of that before, as he was kind of planning for what the life cycle of the equipment was going to be. And so I think I actually just went online to sign on to this bill, because I think it will be very useful information that can be helpful, and also helping our local wastewater folks think about that as they're planning and budgeting years ahead. So just wanted to thank you for bringing this forward.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to recall, it seemed to think that we had real problems in Rushford during the flood with wastewater treatment systems. I certainly know we had problems with drinking water. Do you recall the wastewater problem?
Ms. Kessler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, I do know that Rushford has had wastewater challenges in the past. I don't know specifically what you're referring to, but we can get back to you too with the history of that facility as well.
We have Mr. Johnson who wants to testify. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. It's very briefly, most of my points have already been mentioned, but this is a significant unknown factor for our folks who are trying to do long-term planning for how they're going to finance their systems. We don't know how we're going to handle some of the larger flow events and where that might become a problem for wastewater treatment, not just stormwater runoff issues. And we have inflow and infiltration issues that become a bigger issue as groundwater levels and runoff rise. And the potential change in how long the warm weather cycles do run is a factor in both in treatment and in flow volume. But as you know, we tend to use a lot more water when it's not frozen in this part of the country. And so that also has an impact on our infrastructure needs and uses. So we do support doing a study to find more information out about this. We're going to need it in the future.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, is this information available anyplace else that we're going out to find now?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I am not aware of easy ways to get it. I don't have access to it right now. What I do know is that we do have an infrastructure needs report that we are asked to do biennially by the state. And right now, our folks don't have a way to come up with solid estimates on what's going to be changing related to those kinds of issues. We do know what's coming on the rule docket, for instance. We know what standards we might have to be meeting, those kinds of things, unless they change suddenly. But we do not have the ability. So, for instance, we have facilities that know they're going to need to plan for nitrogen treatment in the future, and they're starting to look at what that would cost if they have to do it. We don't have the same type of knowledge of what's coming on this.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Johnson, when we have trouble in these systems, and Rushford was mentioned from back in 08, Roseau in 02, what are the costs to the cities after an event like those floods? I mean, is the damage that's done in there, is it permanent, or is it something that was a horrible thing that happened at the time, and now we move on and clean up the mess, you might say, hard to pun.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, it depends a lot on the situation, and for instance, whether you qualify for FEMA disaster assistance to help mitigate what happened, because then the local costs get minimized because the state covers most of the match. However, if you're not qualified for that, or if the type of impacts that your system affected, the system that was affected, don't qualify for that, then the local costs go up pretty quickly. And in some cases, it's just not going to be a disaster declaration. It was a very localized problem that part of your system blew out, not that the county had an overwide, you know, a wide problem. So it really varies. So it can range from it's covered, you're going to get repaired, or your ratepayers are going to have to pay the cost to do it. So example from past flooding would be the city of St. Peter, where to do what FEMA allowed them to do would have had them rebuild a wastewater plant in a situation that was again vulnerable for flooding. Rather than take that money, they did it at their own expense and moved it to higher ground. So it really depends on the situation.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there anyone here from PFA? I'm just curious to know. I mean, that's where a lot of this money comes from.
Is there anyone here from the Public Facilities Authority? Looks like not. But we're laying it over.
Yeah, I know that. Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify on the bill? Anyone else who would like to testify? Representative Wolgamott, final comments?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members, for hearing House File 3425. Mr. Chair, members, climate change is real. Climate change is wreaking havoc on our state's wastewater infrastructure, and our constituents expect us to do something about it. Thank you for taking the time to hear this bill, and I appreciate your support.
I'll renew my motion that House File 3425 be laid over as amended for possible inclusion in a future bill. The bill is laid over. Representative Lee. Representative Lee, would you like to move your bill?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 3649.
You recommend it to be referred to Ways and Means.
To be recommended to be referred to Ways and Means.
Representative Lee, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And House File 3649 extends the sunset for the $700,000 of EAB grants to local units of government to develop community ash management plans to identify and convert ash stands to more diverse climate adapted species and to replace, remove ash trees. And we have heard about this just a little bit less than 2 weeks ago from local units of government, from interested stakeholders, and for the DNR about the status of the EAB here in the state of Minnesota.
And you have a testifier?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Hainault, Partnership on Waste and Energy.
Mr. Chair, members of the division, my name is Tony Hainault, and I'm an energy and environment specialist with Hennepin County Public Works. Today I'm speaking on behalf of the Partnership on Waste and Energy. It's a joint powers board of Ramsey, Washington, and Hennepin counties. The partnership works together on energy and waste management issues. Like so many counties, we're in the midst of responding to the Emerald Ash Borer infestation. We're seeing an unprecedented volume of waste wood produced as communities remove trees that are infested. We had a witness from the partnership address to the committee last week during the EAB oversight hearing. At that hearing, we indicated our support for additional appropriations to help manage wood waste as ash trees are lost to the Emerald Ash Borer. Today, we're indicating our support for Representative Lee's legislation, HF 3649, which would extend for 1 year the time frame for use of the appropriation that were approved in the 2019 legislature. We would appreciate preserving these resources for their intended purpose and hope that there will be an opportunity to provide additional resources to help us all respond more effectively to the Emerald Ash Borer infestation. Thank you.
Any questions for the testifier? Members, I have the A1 amendment and would move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like. It is a, when this provision was passed in the special session last summer, the House position had been to take some money from the forest management account in the Natural Resources Fund to identify and convert ash forests on state lands to climate adapted species. I'm inserting that back in with this amendment, and I would move it. And maybe Mr. Hagemeyer, if you could note if there are funds in that account to pay for that.
Mr. Chair, there is some balance in that account that could afford this.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hagemeyer, what is that fund balance?
I don't have it right in front of me, Mr. Fabian. I want to say it's kind of a rolling balance, obviously, because we predict the future revenues coming in, and some of the reimbursement work for school trust lands and such are paid through there. I want to say it's somewhere in the $9 million range, I believe, but the DNR can correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Mr. Chair, I'm sure there's experts here from the DNR that can.
It appears they're up.
Thank you.
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for the opportunity to testify on your amendment. For the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources Assistant Commissioner. While we understand the use of this money is important to fight the spread of emerald ash borer, there are a couple challenges. Challenge to provide sufficiently large planting stock at the State Forest Nursery and live cuttings from state lands in a one-year time frame. $500,000 is a lot of seedlings to plant. Also challenging to identify enough sites and set up planting projects to be successful in a one-year time frame. While we are offering ash and other susceptible species for sale, there's not a lot of market out there right now, and they aren't buying a lot of this timber. So unless we're going to go down and just cut trees down, burn them for energy or whatever we're going to do with them, and then replant, we might want to consider the time frame available for these dollars.
So, Commissioner Meyer, so this talks about having the commissioner identify and convert. So in talking about your concerns, how much of that is identify and how much of that is convert?
Mr. Chairman, it's not that the work isn't necessary. It's just the time frame you're allowing this to be available for. So if you wanted to say these funds are available to expend or something like that, we would be able to do that. It's just trying to get these done, this level of work done with all the other work we have going on within the forestry division, within a year probably we wouldn't be able to do it.
Ms. Taylor, did you hear what he would be a proper way of adding that appropriated until expend?
Mr. Chair, members, I might have Mr. Hagemeyer come, and I know he has some thoughts on this.
Mr. Chair, typically we've been going away from doing the until expended on funds. I know the agencies sometimes like that, but the legislature has gone away from that, and Ways and Means would probably catch you on that one. So probably if they wanted a couple of years, you could do the end of next biennium, June 30th, 2023, I believe. That would give them 3 years to spend it if you wanted to give them a longer period of time.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, what's the balance in the forest management account now? Do you or somebody have that? I asked Mr. Hagemeyer.
Mr. Chairman, I'm assuming Mr. Hagemeyer has that available if he has a recent fund statement on there.
I know he said about nine. I just was. Mr. Chair, he said earlier he said about $9 million, and that was an estimate. I'm just.
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner.
The balance in FMIA, it's important to realize the intricate weave that we have with the forest expense account, the forest management investment account, and our forestry budget. So it's rather complicated, and it's a type of a matrix system. I can certainly share a diagram with the committee in the future. But revenues are deposited into the forest management investment account. Some of that revenue is off of school trust fund land from the suspense account. So it goes in there. It's a revolving account that we use to fund forest management activities. About a decade ago, we gave up general fund dollars when we were in the recession and created the forest management investment account to basically have our forest managed off of a part of the revenue generated off of the forest. So those dollars are in a revolving account that we use for these types of activities. We're doing these types of things right now. This amendment would allow us to accelerate that. Prioritize it in some cases. It's just I want to make sure that we are able to utilize the full appropriation within the need that's there.
Representative Fabian, you know, I would be open to moving it to 2023, but we could do it here, we could do it to Ways and Means. I'd ask your opinion on that. I mean, we're both on Ways and Means, or we can.
Well, I'm not in Ways and Means, but. Yeah, I don't have any trouble with that necessarily. I'm kind of a little apprehensive in that I'd like to know how does the forestry industry feel about doing this, and hear some other testimony if anyone is here from the timber produce people and so forth. I just need a little comfort like I frequently do.
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner.
We've been working closely with the forest industries and the buyers of our timber. They understand this conversion needs to take place. It's a high priority, as I said before. That's why under a sustainable timber harvest, we looked at accelerating ash and replacing it with more sustainable species, especially along the North Shore where we have large populations, and in northern Minnesota where we have large populations that are susceptible to EAB, and trying to get that knocked down and convert it to something that is more disease resistant and more climate friendly as well.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you mentioned that there's no way for you to be able to use this money in this amount of time. And then you also said that you're already doing these things. So assuming you don't get this appropriation right now, where are you at? How far on your track towards accomplishing this goal?
Mr. Chairman. I did not say that we don't need or we wouldn't be able to spend this money. We wouldn't be able to allocate the entire $500,000 in 1 year, is my comments. The conversion really depends on the availability of people to buy the wood at this point in time. We are not converting because the threat isn't there yet, not saying that we wouldn't at some point in time, but we aren't taking down large ash stands and replacing them without a market for the most part. So it's a natural progression. As we can find people to buy the timber, as we can take it down, we're replacing those stands with something else. But we haven't, I don't want us to, the department or the industry to get into the situation where we were 25 years ago or more with aspen, where we didn't have a market, but we were just knocking it down to get it down and reduce the threat of forest fires and things like that. So it's trying to have a market-driven approach to convert our stands is what this amendment would actually help us do, and we would support that extension to 2023.
President Green.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Where are you right now as far as accomplishing the goal. I mean, you got to have some kind of a goal in mind, and whether the money's there or not. Let's forget about the money for a minute. Where are you at right now as far as your timeline for, or maybe you can't answer that right now, but.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, I can provide for you a copy of our 10-year stand examination list, which would show stands of ash and other species that we're trying to get in the queue for harvest over the next decade. So that would provide the information that you're looking for.
Okay, thank you.
Any further discussion on the amendment as it is written? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay? No. Ayes have it. The amendment is adopted to the bill as it is amended. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and urge your support.
Does anyone want to testify to the bill as amended? Representative Lee, do you want to move your, renew your motion?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to renew my motion to send House File 3649 to the Ways and Means Committee.
As amended.
As amended.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay?
No.
Ayes have it. Motion is adopted. House File 3064, Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 3064, and I believe that there is an amendment. And I think it's Representative Lewick's amendment, although I'm happy to move it if he doesn't want
to.
You
want to move it?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File H3064A1 amendment.
Representative Lewick moves the A1 amendment. Representative Becker Finn, are you okay with that amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I am okay with that amendment. It would appropriate some additional funds to Crow Wing County. They went above and beyond in addressing the chronic wasting disease crisis and making sure that they were taking that seriously up in Crow Wing County, and did spend a lot more than even this appropriation to make sure they were disposing of those carcasses appropriately.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Baker Finn. Yes, to expound a little bit more on that. Crow Wing County they actually are incinerating carcasses up there. The DNR had an incinerator. They were able to get a hold of that, did a little bit of work on it, but it's a pretty expensive thing because right off the bat, before you set something like that down, they had to redo their stormwater look because you can't have runoff. I mean, it's a lot, not as simple as just burning a bunch of carcasses. The other thing is, because they are actually taking the residue from the incinerator, they're encapsulating that in a very specific way so that they don't create a future problem within their landfill. And then they added, I mean, to just give an example, one of the things they did is added a fencing to contain that whole area to keep the deer away from where this is going on. That alone was a $100,000 bill to fence that area. So it's we're going to continue to do this for a couple more years, and we'll see if there's additional utility for this. Maybe in other places in the state, last count they burned 80 cord of wood incinerating. So that's another, wood's not free. Hopefully, it was mostly ash. But anyway, I want to thank the bill author for accepting the amendment.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Amendment is adopted. Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I would move House File 3064 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. The bill's pretty straightforward. It's just 10 lines. We're appropriating more money from the general fund to help out with the Adopt a Dumpster program. Essentially, the DNR ended up spending a lot more on this. There was a lot more use by hunters than maybe they were expecting, and I will let them two testifiers here were also helpful in moving this bill forward last year. I do want to give a shout out. There are some folks from Backcountry Hunters and Anglers today. I think it was their lobby day, and they were one of the groups as well as Bluffland Whitetails and the Minnesota Deer Hunters who were also instrumental in making sure this program was effective. And with that, I will turn it over to my testifiers.
Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Zandmuller. I'm the Director of Community and Governmental Relations with Bluffland Whitetail. Briefly, I just want to say happy birthday to the state of Minnesota on this date. In 1849, the Minnesota Territory was established. I'm disappointed there's no cake, but I'll give you another shot next year. I'm here to speak on behalf of House File number 3064, the Adopted Dumpster Program. We've heard many things about chronic wasting disease, but we believe in our organization that it is paramount to contain the disease to the extent possible, to preserve Minnesota's hunting heritage, and to ensure the protection of the rural Minnesota economy that comes from deer hunting. We believe this is a noble purpose. Our organization sponsored a couple of dumpsters this year, ensuring not only that there was the cash up front to do it, but also periodically checking on it, making sure it stayed covered, that there was no illegal dumping done there to our best of our ability. We understand the complexities involved in doing this, but our organization, and I will also speak on behalf of the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. I spoke with Corey Bennett this morning, who wanted me to relay that the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association also finds HF 3064 to be beneficial and urge its passing. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to Mark Norquist from Minnesota Backcountry Hunters and Anglers.
Thank you, Norquist.
Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. I'm just here to also reflect the support that our organization, Mark Norquist, with Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, Minnesota organization. I don't really have anything to add to what Mr. Zandmuller said other than our full support of this bill to really protect the heritage of hunting in Minnesota, the outstate economy, and the health of our wild herd.
Any questions for the testifiers? Is there anyone else who would like to testify? Mr. Ness?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lance Ness, president of the Minnesota Conservation Federation and the Fish and Wildlife Alliance. We support House File 3064.
Great. Any questions? Any other testifiers? Representative Becker Finn.
Mr. Chair, being mindful that I have another bill right after this one, I would renew my motion that House File 3064 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill.
The bill is laid over. Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 3221 to be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. Members, we've had an overview of where the No Child Left Inside grant program is at. I think that was our first hearing this legislative session. On that topic, this would just extend some funds into fiscal year 2021 so that we could continue that program. We had overwhelming support and enthusiasm for Minnesotans about this program, and we want to keep it going. The funds that were set aside last year were just for 1 year, and so we want to make sure we can keep this going given the large public interest in this bill.
Do you have any testifiers? Is there anyone who would like to testify for or against the bill? Are there any questions? Representative Becker Finn, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will note that Chair Ingebrigtsen over in the Senate is also signed on to the Senate version of this bill, so there is bipartisan bicameral support to keep moving this forward. And with that, I would renew my motion for House File 3221 to be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill.
Representative Becker Finn renews her motion that House File 3221 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. We are adjourned.